For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. On today's show, I'll be talking to Winston Churchill's granddaughter, Princess Margaret's lady-in-waiting. We'll have the comedian and crime writer who followed in Johnson and Boswell's footsteps. We'll also hear some footnotes from history, the story of the woman the Scott expedition left behind, and how one man's life changed when he first touched clay. All that and more on today's Read On. Today's show was recorded at the wonderful Dumfries House at the Boswell Book Festival, the world's only festival of biography and memoir. Inspired by the great Ayrshire writer James Boswell of Auchinleck, the unique theme is taken from the genre at which he excelled, the telling of people's life stories. Red Sail couldn't join me at the festival, so you're in the company of me, Robert Kirkwood, for the next hour, in which we'll hear from Denise Mina and Frank Skinner on retracing Boswell and Johnson's grand tour of Scotland. With Catherine McInnes, we'll examine the lives of the Snow Widows left behind by Scott's ill-fated South Pole expedition. Andrew O'Hagan tells us about his book Mayflies and how working for Blind Veterans UK helped him to become a better writer. Emma Soames will talk about Mary Churchill's War. Giles Milton gives us some fascinating footnotes from history. And Lady-in-Waiting to Princess Margaret, Lady Glenconner, tells us about her depiction in The Crown and narrating an audiobook at the age of 89. But first, on today's packed show, let's chat to Keith Brimmer-Jones, judge on Channel 4's The Great Pottery Throwdown. Keith Brimmer-Jones is the star presenter and judge of Channel 4's The Great Pottery Throwdown. Famous for his emotional responses to the heartfelt and personal pieces made by the contestants on the show. In Boy in a China Shop, his first ever memoir, Keith tells the story of his life and inspiring rise to success through the objects and images that have been meaningful to him every step of the way. And despite having severe dyslexia, Keith read the audiobook.
This was how I kept myself sane during the first COVID-19 lockdown in 2020. Doing what I love most. Of course, for the first few days, my partner Marge and I didn't know what to do with ourselves. We had no reference points. We had never seen shops, pubs and restaurants shut down en masse before, and no one had ever forbidden us to see our friends and family, or anyone else for that matter. It was unnerving, but after those first tense days, I stopped stressing about work and then stopped stressing about everything. I was first approached by Hodder to do my biography, which I was very flattered by, and I'm not much of a writer, obviously, I'm a potter, and they suggested getting me a ghostwriter in to do it. And actually, I suggested that my eldest friend, who is actually a writer, write the book with me. And so that's what happened. So Mick James, who's I've known since teenagers, he helped me write the book, and we wrote it together. And it was fascinating. And we came up with this concept of each chapter really starts with either a person or an object that was quite significant in that that point of my life, and we weave the story, slightly technical story, and the history of said object or person into the chapter about my life, and it really it's a book about the algorithm of life, basically how you make a decision, and as random as it may be, the universe just provides you with a different path. And it's, amazing,
How did the universe provide you with clay?
Well, the universe provided me with clay through an art teacher called Mr. Mortman. You know, we all remember an inspirational teacher at school. It's amazing. And mine was Mr. Mortman at school, secondary school, gave me my first lump of clay, as he did with all the other people in my class. Half of them started doing a clay fight, and the other half, which I was in the latter of, we started actually making something. So, and the moment I touched the clay, it was just an amazing experience. Yeah, I knew then I was going to be a potter. Yeah, it's just such an malleable, tactile material that the way I describe it is, it's basically your the potential of your imagination on a bench, and at the time. I didn't realise at the time, but the importance of me being dyslexic, of which I am, it's the perfect medium for someone who's dyslexic, because someone who has dyslexia has a much better affinity with shape, form and volume. Quite a lot of architects are severely... Norman Foster, severely dyslexic. So it obviously tapped into that part of my brain, and it was just perfect. Yeah, loved it. It's an extremely tactile, sensual experience, and I don't mind admitting that I'm addicted to it. The connection is so profound. It's like the clay is an extension of me. It's all over in a flash. I think that's another integral part of the process that I find so appealing. It has to be done at speed, in one continuous movement. There's no time to stop and think about it. It is 2 or 3 minutes of total concentration. The best part is when I've finished, I can pick up another lump of clay and do it again and again.
Now, talking of dyslexia, you narrated the audiobook.
Yes.
How was that?
It was good. Yeah, it was eventful. It was good. But it was a bit of a challenge. But it's amazing what they can do with modern technology these days. And it was really good. And I'm glad I did it. It was over 3 days. And it was wonderful. And apparently, the engineer told me I wasn't the worst. So that helped. It was a great experience. Yeah, I had a lot of banter with the engineer. He was a lovely chap. We recorded it down in Soho in London. And it was great because it was an old haunt of mine when I was in the band days. And so it was great having to go to work there for 3 days. So it was brilliant. Yeah, loved it. I'm always, you know, when you do anything creative, you're always faced with challenges every day. And it's always good to try and overcome them. It gives you greater confidence. And one of the biggest sayings in my life that I sort of live by is, a pessimist's problem is an optimist's opportunity. And I love that saying because you can turn things around to your advantage, no matter how bad they are.
So I settled into a nice little routine. I'd get up an hour or two after my usual waking hour, enjoy a leisurely breakfast, something previously totally unknown to me, and then sit down at my wheel to centre some clay and make something just for the hell of it.
Boy in a China Shop, written and read by Keith Brimmer-Jones, is available commercially now. And we'll be back with Keith at the end of the show for the books of his life.
Snow Widows by Catherine MacInnis is the untold story of Scott's fatal Antarctic expedition through the eyes of the woman they left behind. The men of Captain Scott's polar party were heroes of their age, enduring tremendous hardships to further the reputation of the empire they served by reaching the South Pole. But they were also husbands, fathers, sons and brothers. For the first time, the story of the race for the South Pole is told from the perspective of the women whose lives would be forever changed by it. 5 women who offer a window into a lost age and a revealing insight into the thoughts and feelings of the 5 heroes.
Who were the hitherto invisible wives and mothers? The Snow Widows, behind that most famous selfie of 5 doomed men lined up at the South Pole on the 18th of January, 1912. Scott of the Antarctic still drags his sledge through eponymous archives, official diaries and authorised biographies. But in order to answer that question, I have chased the Snow Widows through dusty attics and auction rooms and sifted them from history's cutting room floors. My aim has been not to analyse, but to try to place the stories in their historical context and let the women speak for themselves. Out of choice, I would take a seat that gave me a clear view into the wings of the theatre, the dancers warming up, the actors mastering their nerves. I want to see the back of the embroidery, an X-ray of that famous picture, the making of at the end of a film. To that end, the story you are about to hear is full of contradictions, many of which I have deliberately left in, and it is built on the premise that the minutiae of everyday life reveals as much as the major historical events that shape our lives.
It's about the five women who were the wives and mothers of the five men who went to the South Pole with Scott in 1912. And instead of finishing with the deaths of those five men, it goes on to tell you what happened to them next.
And it's the first time we've really heard their story.
It is the first time. Kathleen Scott wrote an autobiography. I have written a biography of Oriana Wilson, one of the women, but the other three have never been written about. And so as a collective group biography, it's completely new material.
And they were quite an eclectic mix. I mean, among the wives, there was a singer, a sculptress and a scientist.
There was, and a headmistress. And Caroline Oates was the lady of the manor of Gestingthorpe in Essex. So she was extremely rich. Her father was an engineer in Leeds, actually. She kept three sets of servants, one in Essex, one in London, and her sons in India, because he was a cavalry officer based in India. So it gives you quite a good cross-section of just post-Edwardian society and that very interesting part of history just before the First World War, at the sort of when the British Empire, when the sun never set on the British Empire until the beginning of the First World War. So massive change happened at this point.
It was a very British affair.
It was a very British affair. So it was a time when the empire was still expanding. George V had just gone out to India, to the Delhi Durbar, so he'd been crowned in India as well. The idea was that the British went out and colonised somewhere and brought British culture and democracy and legal systems and religion. And so the bid for the South Pole was done in the spirit of that enterprise. Amundsen, the Norwegian explorer who actually got to the South Pole first, used Eskimo techniques. So he used dogs, sledges and fur, and he ruthlessly shot the dogs and fed them to each other. He didn't have any problem with that, whereas the British expedition thought of dogs as pets, and they wore British clothes, British-made Jaeger suits and that kind of thing, because they didn't want to go native. That was considered to be sort of not very British, as you said.
This story is set just over a century ago, when attitudes to the role of women, to class, education, religion, parenting, marriage, race and sexuality were very different, when the most women could hope for was to be, as even Scott acknowledged they often were, the real power behind the throne.
Jane McDowell reads the audiobook. What did you think of the parts you've heard?
I thought it was very beautifully clear and well read. Quite interesting that she used an Italian accent to say Terra Nova. So the whole story is based around the Terra Nova expedition from 1910 to 1913. And she says Terra Nova rather than Terra Nova, which was the Latin. So it really was a Latin name for new earth, new worlds.
Do you not fancy reading it yourself?
I wasn't given the option. I would have liked to have read it myself, actually. But it is quite a long book. I know that people have enjoyed it. Somebody was saying that they stopped the car and stayed in the car listening to it when they were. So that's good. And I think it's always such a luxury to be read to. But yes, it would have been interesting to read parts of it myself. I also think it would work very well with male and female voices, because the story is told between 10 people. So it's the same story going forwards in one direction chronologically, but I keep giving it to a different voice, so to a different woman or a different man. Hopefully you just get one narration, but you could use different voices.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I always listened to, have always historically listened to tapes, then CDs and, you know, podcasts. And yes, so I do listen to audiobooks. I listened to Hilary Mantel when I drove from Cheltenham to Norfolk and back. And that was just fantastic. It lasted the whole distance.
Instead of superimposing modern values, this historical context invites you to time travel to a bygone era, to understand a mindset that is completely alien to us now. And so this is written with an awareness of meta-biography. It will not be a comfortable ride. It is too easy both to be wise in retrospect and to be swept up by the glamour of adventure without having to consider the collateral impact for those on the shelf.
Snow Widows by Catherine MacInnis is read by Jane McDowell and is available commercially now.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show, recorded live at the Boswell Book Festival. In attendance was Scottish author Andrew O'Hagan. Born in Glasgow, brought up in Irvine and educated in Kilwinning, which we'll talk about in a moment. He's been nominated for the Booker, is the author of both fiction and non-fiction, and had an early job editing the magazine for Blind Veterans UK. He gave two talks at Boswell, one about the town Kilwinning and one about his book Mayflies, the audio version of which is read by Andrew himself.
Tully Dawson made himself new to the world and ripe for the glories of that summer by showing he was unlike his father. It wasn't a matter to fight over. Some families are made up of strangers and nothing can change it. But I think it always bothered Tully that Woodbine couldn't cheer him on when he came by the football field to watch the game. The old man would only shake his head in a know-all way and stare at the Firth of Clyde with an injured look.
So Mayflies is a book that grows out of an old friendship I had in Ayrshire in the 1980s. That friendship was put to the test 30 years later when one of the characters in the partnership is ill. And I wanted to write a book that was about the shape of a whole friendship over time. And these lifelong friendships we have, they rival any other kind of relationship in our lives, really. But I hadn't ever read the novel about it that I wanted to read, you know, about how somebody who's been in your life for decades, that the loss of them can go right to the heart and bring memories back in a way that I think novels can, you know, that they portray the shape of a life in such a way as to make it resonant and explain why it's lasted so long.
Now, you've written fiction and non-fiction. Is this a sort of blend of the two?
I've always been interested in the relationship between what's real and what's imagined. As a writer, the two things have always sat quite close to each other for me, and they've fed into each other in quite a big way. I mean, I started my career with a non-fiction book, which people writing about the book at the time said that it read like a novel, although it was all verifiable and true. And I went on from there to write novels, which have always depended, I think, quite naturally and quite heavily on lived experience. But this book, I think, more than any book of mine, has become almost a piece of auto-fiction, a piece of like a memory play almost, where I try to animate the forces from my own life. Obviously, there are liberties and embroideries, and as a writer, you sometimes turn the colours up in the room and change the narrative a wee bit. But fundamentally, it's a very autobiographical piece of prose.
And yesterday you gave a talk on Kilwinning, not where you were born and brought up, but where you were educated. What was it about Kilwinning that shaped you?
Well, it was a wee Scottish town in Ayrshire, not far from the sea, where people were living in close proximity. There were quite hard times in the 80s. You know, it's an unemployment black spot during those Thatcher years. But the culture was very strong locally, you know, not just the culture of Robert Burns and James Boswell. You know, here we are at the Boswell Book Festival celebrating James Boswell in a way. And, you know, he was one of the voices in my head at that young age, but also the culture of teenagehood, of punk bands and, you know, street life. Kilwinning was an absolutely fully animated kind of wonder zone for me at that age. I mean, people would laugh at that because in some ways it's a modest wee place, but for me It was the landscape of my imagination. And that landscape of your early imagination tends to last. It's the kind of, if you like, the hidden sight, the sixth sense that a writer has all their career. They rely again and again on this stock of images from their early days.
Now, we know between Co-Winning and between your first novel, there was a job with Blind Veterans UK. How did that shape your writing, describing things for these people who couldn't see?
I was very devoted to that job I had at Blind Veterans UK. It was called St Dunstan's in those days. And I came to that job partly as an assistant editor on an in-house magazine, which also went on to Braille and became a talking book. But also, part of the job was to explain on trips to the South Downs and to parts of England what I could see, and using, in a sense, lending my eyes and my imagination. His eyes are only one thing. The stronger organ is the imagination, as we know. And lending these things to ex-soldiers, some of whom in those days, I can tell you, were survivors of the First World War. These were among the last 200 or 300 men who'd survived the trenches, and I'd be with them in the South Downs, marching one guy after the other. I'd invented a system of having a clothes pole, and I'd hold the front of it, and they'd all hold along the way as we marched very merrily. Well, they would say from pub to pub if they were telling the truth, but we went across the Downs, and I'd read them poetry and describe what I could see. And it was, I have to tell you, a formative experience for a young writer, mainly because it showed me how to pay attention. It was like an apprenticeship in sense imagination. It made me try to take nothing for granted in terms of what could be seen, what could pass through the eye. And I found those men, despite having been blinded for many, many decades in their cases by then, they had the most vivid sight of any group of men I'd ever met.
Now, taken from that, is it important that your books are available in audio for everyone?
It's absolutely crucial to me, not only as a former worker for Blind Veterans UK, but as somebody with a friend and business partner who is a registered blind individual. My friend Sam, with whom I own Sam's Cafe in London, is a man who grew up with a deteriorative disease. He was partially sighted for a long time and now fully without sight, but he is one of the busiest, most exuberant and most appreciative guys about everyday life that I know. And for him and for all people who are partially sighted or have trouble with their eyes in one way or another, it's crucial to me as a novelist that those books of mine are available as talking books.
Tully had named him after the cigarettes. They all had their nicknames, those reluctant fathers. They sat at home opening cans of lager and cursing our Saturday nights. I suppose we could have drifted over to the touchline and asked his opinion, but being young is a kind of warfare in which the great enemy is experience.
I was absolutely delighted this time to be the voice of the book and to record the whole audiobook myself. The publishers asked me to early on, and you know, I didn't hesitate, because this is a book very much in the first person, very much from my life, and it felt natural to give it the voice that authored it, if you like. I'm a great fan of talking books. I listen to dozens of them a year. So it was a thrill for me personally to be able to record my own very personal book onto audiobook for other people to hear. I've always been a bit of an actor in a sense, and loved finding voices. Writers are, but novelists especially, we sit at our desks sort of impersonating our characters, sometimes physically, with our voices and expressions. So it was a natural thrill for me to get into the studio for 3 days and record the whole book. I really loved doing it.
I wasn't meant to go to university. We weren't that kind of family. Very soon, we weren't any kind of family at all. My dad wandered off in search of himself. "You might begin by looking up your own backside," said my mother, Norma.
Mayflies, written and read by Andrew O'Hagan, is available commercially now. It's also available, along with many other Andrew O'Hagan books, in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Mary was just 16 years old when she resolved to keep a diary at the beginning of 1939. Her early entries capture the innocence of the last days of her childhood, spent in comparative isolation in the beautiful countryside around Chartwell, the family home in Kent. Her religious faith and her love of riding are evident, while episodes of teenage angst are interspersed with occasional forays into a more glamorous adult world. She is unquestioningly loyal to her papa, but initially at least, the political news and deteriorating international situation only occasionally intrude into her cosy domestic narrative.
Emma Soames is a legendary journalist, former editor of the Literary Review, Tatler, Saga, Evening Standard and Telegraph magazines, and she's also the granddaughter of Winston Churchill. In her book, Mary Churchill's War, she edits her mother's diaries, many of which have never been published, and provides a unique front row view of the great events of war, as well as exchanges and intimate moments with her father. They also show an impulsive and spirited writer, untrammelled by hindsight or self-censorship, or nostalgia. In 1939, 17-year-old Mary found herself in an extraordinary position at an extraordinary time. It was the outbreak of the Second World War, and her father, Winston Churchill, had been appointed First Lord of the Admiralty. Within months, he would be Prime Minister. The young Mary Churchill was uniquely placed to observe this remarkable historical moment, but also capture what it was like to be a young woman during wartime.
Mary accompanies her parents to France in August, though the worsening political situation means that her father both goes out first and comes back early. Suddenly, war seems so horribly near, so inevitable. On the 1st of September, Germany moves against Poland after having first secured a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. Prime Minister Chamberlain recalls Churchill to the War Cabinet as First Lord of the Admiralty. 2 days later, the British ultimatum to Berlin expires and war with Germany is declared. They are the wartime diaries of my mother, who it was called Mary Soames, but before that, when she wrote them, she was Mary Churchill, and she was the youngest daughter of the war Prime Minister, Winston Churchill.
And how did the book come about?
Well, she left her diaries to Churchill College, Cambridge, to the Archive Centre. And after her death, I'm her literary executor, and we looked at the diaries and decided that although she had used some of the material out of the diaries in her memoir, A Daughter's Tale, there was lots of other rich things in the years she covered, and so we decided to publish.
Sunday, the 1st of January. Saw 1939 out and 1939 in with Punch at Breckles. Went for longish walk in AM with Nana. Walked again in PM. Great fun and most energetic. Read mainly after tea. My resolutions are: 1. To say prayers much more carefully. 2. To be much more regular, read letters, accounts, etc., and especially my zoo is to be attended to. 3. To have greater strength of purpose. 4. To keep a diary. 5. To read lots of good books. I am really going to try to keep these. May God bless my year and be with all those I love.
Now, you're an editor yourself. How hard was it to decide what to leave in and what to cut out?
Well, really, there was certainly no sort of censorship, but for length, I did cut. Really, where it's a bit repetitious. I mean, you know, like all teenagers, she did go on a bit about her state of mind or her, you know, her appearance or something. So we kept a bit of that, but at the same time, we took out the repetitious bits.
And she said some of it may have been hot-making.
Yes, her word for embarrassing was hot-making. And I think some of these diaries she would have regarded as hot-making because they were a teenager, an innocent teenager talking. But that is also part of their charm.
You read some of the audiobook. How was that?
Yes, I've read all the bits that aren't my mother talking because obviously I do not sound like a 17-year-old girl. But I've read the introduction. I read the introduction of each year. At the beginning of each year, we've got a page or so explaining what was going on in the war and in the world at that point, which makes it then when you start reading the text of the diaries, you don't have to keep thinking what was going on then. I read all that, and then there's a very good actress who the publishers use a lot, and she reads She Is My Mother.
Friday, 6th of January. Read and finished Bleak House during day. I enjoyed it very much, but the ending was not altogether satisfactory, what with Richard dying and Caddy's baby being a deaf mute. And anyway, I don't believe I ever got over Esther being pockmarked. Road in PM. Fears rehunting because of frost. After tea, rang up Sam Marsh, who runs the local riding school. No hunting. Boo-hoo. But 2 hours later, Sam Marsh rang me. Weather forecasts and thaw made prospect of hunting probable. Whoopee! Oh dear, God is so wonderful. I do appreciate everything he does.
I think she's done a very good job, and it you know, it bounces along at quite a good pace. It's not sort of, you know, you don't long to put 1.5, increase the speed. You don't feel like doing that.
Now, during your talk, and just to end this, you told about your big brother.
Yes. So when he was a very old man living at Chartwell, my elder brother, Nicholas, once bounced into his study and said, Grandpapa, is it true that you're England's greatest man? And Grandpapa said, yes, now bugger off.
Saturday, 18th of March. The German invasion of Czechoslovakia crisis seems to be becoming more serious. Papa said, before God Almighty, I swear I do not wish for war. I write this as a witness.
From air raid sirens at 10 Downing Street to seeing action with the ETS, from cocktail parties with presidents and royals to accompanying her father on key diplomatic trips, Mary's wartime diaries are full of colour, rich in historical insight and a charming and intimate portrait of life alongside Winston Churchill. They're narrated by Beth Eyre and Emma Soames and available commercially now.
Now, staying roughly in that time period, Giles Milton is a historian and internationally best-selling author of 12 books of narrative history, including D-Day, Nathaniel's Nutmeg, and Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. He gave 2 talks at Boswell, the first about Checkmate in Berlin, the first battle of the Cold War, and the second talk was on Fascinating Footnotes from History, detailing 100 of the quirkiest historical nuggets. Examples being, where did Agatha Christie disappear to for 11 days? The cabin boy on the Hindenburg who lived to tell the tale? The Japanese soldier still fighting the Second World War in 1974. And in a moment, we'll find out who really killed Rasputin. Footnotes is read by Giles Milton.
The question that remained unanswered was whether or not Mallory and Irvin had made it to the summit. Did they die on their way up or on their way down? The team hoped they might find Mallory's camera. Experts at Kodak had said that the film, though old, might yet be developed. But when the men reached inside the pouch around Mallory's neck, they found only a metal tin of stock cubes. Brand and Co. Savory meat lozenges. There was other evidence as well. A brass altimeter, a pocket knife, a monogrammed handkerchief, and a pair of undamaged sun goggles in an inside pocket. More tantalising was an item that the searchers had expected to find on Mallory's body. He was known to have been carrying a photograph of his wife Ruth, which he had vowed to leave on the summit. The photo was nowhere to be found, even though his wallet and other papers were intact.
Footnotes is a collection of stories that I've sort of gathered over the years, things that are just so strange or so unknown or so weird or so wonderful, perhaps not worthy of an entire full-length book, but just worthy of being written about. They often involve incredible characters who've done incredible things.
because you are known for much longer form history. Is it just things you've found and put in a drawer?
Yeah, just often they're sort of quirky stories or stories that you just can't quite believe. I mean, one of my favourite ones is the story of the murder or the assassination of Rasputin. Traditionally, it's always believed to be Prince Yusupov who killed him in this sort of demonic frenzy of bloodshed. But in fact, in recent years, the autopsy report of Rasputin was found, and it now seems almost certain that Rasputin was actually killed by Oswald Rayner, Prince Yusupov's friend from Oxford University, who was working for the Secret Intelligence Service. So it was actually a British agent who killed Rasputin.
And Stalin robbed a bank.
Stalin did rob a bank. A lot of people don't know that. But when he was young and lawless, living in his native Georgia, Tbilisi, he pulled off an incredible bank heist, robbing, you know, hundreds of what would now be hundreds of thousands of pounds to help finance what would become the Bolshevik Revolution. He was a terrible chap when he was young.
We are on the radio station of RNIB, and you read the audio version of this.
I did.
How was that?
It's exhausting to do, but very rewarding. I really enjoy doing it. It takes about 5 days. You sit in a tiny little padded studio. You feel you're in some sort of asylum, actually, and you read the book. They do what's called rock and roll recording, where every time you make a mistake, you go back to the beginning of the previous sentence. But at the end of that week, they have an absolute perfect recording. But I sort of love doing it and try and throw quite a lot of energy into doing it, which means I am exhausted by the end of the day.
Yesterday was a much different book about the First Battle of the Cold War.
Yes, this was my book Checkmate in Berlin, which tells the story of Berlin between 1945 and 1949. And it's essentially the tale of this divided city as it gradually tears itself apart with the Soviets in the east, the Brits, Americans and French in the west. And really the beginnings of the Cold War and the shaping of modern Europe. So it's a big story. It's a big geopolitical story in a way, but told through the personalities of the four commandants of the four sectors of Berlin. Grand-scale diplomacy requires a grand-scale entourage, and Yalta was to outshine all of the previous wartime summits in both scale and extravagance. Touching down at Saki within minutes of the two leaders was an aerial armada of 25 transport planes, codename Mission Number 17, bringing 750 accredited participants. Among them were Churchill's most trusted confidants, including his Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden and his Chief of Staff General Sir Hastings Pug Ismay. Roosevelt's delegation was of equal calibre, led by his Secretary of State Edward Stettinius and his special adviser Harry Hopkins. Hundreds of others were following in their wake: field marshals, generals, ministers, soldiers, aides, advisers, translators, stenographers, secretaries, signallers, cooks and stewards. Roosevelt brought 18 bodyguards, as well as his presidential outriders, nicknamed the Crazy Gang by the British secretarial staff.
Checkmate in Berlin, fascinating footnotes from history, and many other books written and narrated by Giles Milton are available commercially now.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support, whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, "Alexa, call RNIB helpline" for more information. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show recorded on location at the Boswell Book Festival. In attendance were Frank Skinner and Denise Mina, there to talk about their TV shows, Wordsworth and Coleridge's Romantic Road Trip, and of course, Boswell and Johnson's Scottish Road Trip.
In 1773, the famous English writer Samuel Johnson made a grand tour of Scotland. He was accompanied by his friend, the Edinburgh-born James Boswell, and both wrote accounts of their travels. I'm going to follow in their footsteps.
Hello, Frank, how are you?
Like Boswell.
And like Johnson, my travelling companion is a best-selling Scottish writer, Denise Minor.
I'll talk to them both about the TV show in a moment, but first I asked Frank Skinner how he was enjoying Ayrshire.
I really like being in Auchinleck. I walked from my hotel room to the place where we have dinner on the first night I arrived. And I think it was the first time I realised how filthy the air is in London. Because I thought, what is that? What is that stuff in my lungs that I don't recognise? Oh, it's air. So the air is beautiful. And then today, and I honestly, in my hand, your listeners will have to trust me on this, I'm holding the programme for the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum. And I went absolutely through the Burns ceiling this morning. So I went to the Birthplace Museum. I stood on Brigadoon, and I was on Brigadoon, and a man stopped me and played me two tracks from his album. He was a singer-songwriter who was passing by. I wasn't expecting that. But the whole Burns thing, the cottage and that, it was brilliant. I'm so fired up now to get home and read Burns for 2 weeks.
So I'm sitting with a copy of Frank Skinner by Frank Skinner. How long ago did you write this?
That was published in 2000. In fact, it was the second highest-selling autobiography in 2000. Second only to A Child Called It. I don't know if you remember that. Mine had got more jokes.
So you're both here because of your Sky Arts show. Tell us about that.
Frank picks the subject usually because Frank's very broadly read. So it's usually two people who've been on a journey together. We take a character each, and then we basically get to go on a jolly for 3 weeks.
And absolutely wallow in that particular writer, which is fab. Because often when you're sort of reading, I don't know, William Wordsworth, for example, you think, I should be doing some work now. So if you can actually move things around so it is work, then that is when life is happy.
You know what Mark Twain said? Make your vocation your vacation. And that's
very
what we've
good.
Done.
And do you know what Noel Coward said? Work is much more fun than fun.
Did he?
Yeah, he did. Oh, I love that. And it is in this line of work.
Yeah, so we're very lucky. We keep getting to do it over and over again.
And, of course, the first one was, well, at the Boswell Book Festival, was Boswell's Journey.
Yeah, so I was mad about Samuel Johnson. And so I wanted to do this thing. But I said, I'm going to need a Scottish person, a Boswell person. And I think it should be a woman because, you know, I don't want it to be another, like, two white guys talking about two white guys. So I was sent a bunch of people and I got to...
We did an audition. He was sent videos of
people. Yeah, videos. I mean, they didn't arrive in a chain gang. And I meant videos. And there was one of you being interviewed by Craig Ferguson, one of Denise being interviewed by Craig Ferguson. I honestly got about 3 minutes in and thought, that's the one. So so that was fab. And it's been brilliant. I think we... I don't want to speak for Denise, but I think we like exploring each other's heads a bit. And there's a lot of that when we just get a chance to absolutely chew over various literary, historical, political issues. It's bliss.
It is, honestly. It's absolutely, I mean, I think we met at Dr. Johnson's house and it was kind of like, are you going to get on? And after about 3 minutes, Frank said to the producer, Franny, I think you can leave us alone. I think we're going to be on.
Yeah, I think they were getting, in case they needed to separate us physically.
This is a fight.
What was it like getting the phone call saying you'd got the job?
Well, I didn't know I was up for the job. They just said, would you like to do this? And I said, oh, Frank Skinner's brilliant. Everybody says that. But No, they do, actually. Okay. They do. Okay. They don't
I raise
know
my
you.
Eyebrows.
They don't know you,
case.
Frank. They don't know you at all. And I thought, oh, that'd be great. But, I mean, you know, one of the things about being a writer is you're always looking for adventures to get involved in. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So even if it's a bad adventure, if you end up stuck at a book festival in the middle of Spain and there's nothing but blood sausage and bagpipes, which has actually happened to me, it's still an adventure. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
But so sometimes they're quite arduous, but this one has been a total joy. We just get to be really nerdy, and the access we get, that's the thing that always gets me, is we get access to, I think if you say to people, we have a TV company, can we come and
They'll say, come and hold William Wordsworth's wedding ring or something like that, and you actually get to do that. Yeah. That thing, that access
thing. You can tell from how hushed we sound, how thrilled we are by that stuff.
Yeah. But I went to see, Denise gave a talk today because she wrote a book about Mary, Queen of Scots, and I went to the talk at the Boswell Book Festival, which was brilliant. But she was talking in that about getting a private tour of Holyrood Castle and all that. And I thought, yeah, that is the best thing about this job is I've spent years looking over people's shoulders at art exhibitions trying to see the picture. And suddenly someone says, oh, yeah, you can come and see it, but come at 6 o'clock at night when it's shot. And that, oh, man, that. I used to dream about getting into the toy shop down the road after it was shot. And it's like that.
There are many books by Denise Mina in the RNIB Talking Books Library and available commercially. Frank Skinner's book, Frank Skinner on the Road, is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Adrian Grove. Frank Skinner by Frank Skinner and Frank Skinner, A Comedian's Prayer Book are both available in audio commercially now. Lady in Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown is a memoir of drama, tragedy and royal secrets by Anne Glenconner. She has been at the centre of the royal circle from childhood, when she met and befriended the future Queen Elizabeth II and her sister, the Princess Margaret. Though the firstborn child of the 5th Earl of Leicester, who controlled one of the largest estates in England, as a daughter she was deemed the greatest disappointment and unable to inherit. Since then, she has needed all her resilience to survive court life with her sense of humour intact. A unique witness to landmark moments in royal history, Lady in Waiting is written and narrated by Anne Glenconner.
One morning at the beginning of 2019, when I was in my London flat, the telephone rang. Hello, Lady Glenconner, it's Helena Bonham Carter. It's not every day a Hollywood film star rings me up, although I had been expecting her call. When the producers of the popular Netflix series The Crown contacted me, saying that I was going to be portrayed by Nancy Carroll in the third series, and that Helena Bonham Carter had been cast as Princess Margaret, I was delighted. Asked whether I minded meeting them so they could get a better idea of my friendship with Princess Margaret, I said I didn't mind in the least. Nancy Carroll came to tea, and we sat in armchairs in my sitting room and talked. The conversation was surreal, as I became extremely self-aware, realising that Nancy must be absorbing what I was like. I was asked to write a book when I was 87, and I said, well, I can't possibly do that. I'm far too old. So they said, oh, well, dictate it. Sit and just dictate it. And it worked very, very well because I've sold nearly a million copies. It's been translated into 14 different languages. And I'm going to be 90 this summer. So it's never too late to, you know. I feel extremely lucky to be in this position. And I'm delighted to be in Scotland for the Boswell Literary Festival at Dumfries House. Heard so much about it. And we went yesterday to see the Wall Garden, which I thought was completely magical.
Now, what I think is remarkable is you narrated the audio version of the book yourself.
Oh, yes, well, I did. My great friend is Rupert Everett, the actor, and I said I was going to read, and he said, no, Anne, that would be too difficult, it's too exhausting, which made me absolutely determined that I would do it. But I did have one of the sort of unexpected things, was my tongue swelled up. I talked every day for about 5 hours, so I had to suck cubes of ice. Anyway, I did it, and I think a lot of people have liked it and have said, you know, that because I read it, it means much more to people. My earliest memories of Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret came from when I was 2 or 3 years old. Princess Elizabeth 5 years older, which was quite a lot. She's rather grown up. But Princess Margaret was only 3 years older, and we became firm friends. She was naughty, funny and imaginative, the very best sort of friend to have. We used to rush round Holkham, past the grand pictures, whirling through the labyrinth of corridors on our trikes, or jumping out at the nursery footmen as they carried huge silver trays from the kitchen. Princess Elizabeth was much better behaved. "Please don't do that, Margaret," or "You shouldn't do that, Anne," she would scold us. In one photograph, we are all standing in a line. Princess Elizabeth is frowning at Princess Margaret, suspecting she's up to no good, while Princess Margaret is staring down at my shoes. Years afterwards, I show Princess Margaret the photo and ask, "Ma'am, why were you looking at my feet?" And she replied, "Well, I'm so jealous because you had silver shoes and I had brown ones."
And of course, you're in the public eye at the moment because you were depicted in The Crown. Did you watch it?
Well, I didn't actually watch The Crown. I did watch the bit I was in. I couldn't resist. It was absolute rubbish, really, but quite fun. I don't think the royal family watched it. I must say, I don't blame them. But actually, when it first started, being one of the maids of honour, we had a special showing, and that was rather good. I think it started off rather well, and then I think it's gone completely off-piste at the moment. The bit I was in, I hoped that it would be filmed, because my husband's family home is in Peeblesham, the Glen, just above Traquair, and I rather hope they might film it there, but I think that that was probably too expensive. So they filmed it in the really grotty country club, and I'm sitting by a pool, Princess Margaret and me, in sort of bikinis, and I'm sort of pimping for her. I'm saying, "Look, ma'am, do you like that young man over there? Hasn't he got a cute bottom?" You know, I mean, complete rubbish. I'm so glad that darling Princess Margaret is no longer, and so she wasn't able to see it with me, because it would have been very, very embarrassing.
Lady in Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown by Anne Glenconner is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. At the start of today's show, we heard from Keith Brimmer-Jones, ceramicist and sometimes emotional host and judge on the Great Pottery Throwdown. At the Boswell Book Festival, I asked about the books of his life.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an avid reader because of the aforementioned, really, but one book that really, really struck me, and quite frankly, it was probably the illustrations in the book at first, but it was the whole story of Robinson Crusoe and how he found himself on an island and he had to make do and mend and create a home for himself. And I've kind of got this lovely romantic idea of just living in the mountains with a penknife and nothing else and just staying there, really. And that really tapped into my imagination. Yeah, loved it.
I soon found the place I was in was not for my settlement, particularly because it was upon a low, moorish ground near the sea, and I believed would not be wholesome, and more particularly because there was no fresh water near it. So I resolved to find a more healthy and more convenient spot of ground. I consulted several things in my situation which I found would be proper for me. First, health and fresh water, I just now mentioned. Secondly, shelter from the heat of the sun. Thirdly, security from ravenous creatures, whether man or beast. Fourthly, a view to the sea, that if God sent any ship in sight, I might not lose any advantage for my deliverance, of which I was not willing to banish all my expectation yet.
The RNIB version of Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe is read by Stephen Thorne.
And this may come back to pottery, but what sort of books do you go back to on a rainy day to reread?
The story of Lucy Rhee. Lucy Rhee is a famous contemporary sort of potter, and she really inspired me when I was young, and she still inspires me now. She's sadly died, but I'm constantly reading books on Lucy Rhee. Love her, yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, Lucy Rhee, Modernist Potter by Emmanuel Cooper, is only available in audio by using text to speech.
Is there a book that you'd recommend reading just now?
Well, funnily enough, being in a studio, Radio 4 was amazing. Because I'm working with Clay and I can listen to the radio without any kind of interruptions. And for me, Nothing But the Truth by The Secret Barrister was an audio book, a book of the week on Radio 4. And it was so wonderful. I actually bought the audio book and I'm listening to it now in my studio. So it's wonderful, yeah.
It wasn't how you're making it sound, yeah?
The joy. I hear a stifled snort from the Crown Prosecution Service paralegal sitting on the row in front of me. My cross-examination, as written out neatly in the standard-issue blue counsel's notebook perched on my lectern, was going to end on that last over-gestated question. But now, not only is Mr. Tuttle giving the jury an implausible story, he's trying to wriggle out of it. The one thing worse than a liar is a liar lying about being a liar. So I treat myself to an encore. It wasn't how I made it sound. Nah. Well, we know Mr. Martins is blind, yes?
Yes.
And you agree he was on crutches?
Yes.
And you say that he hit you first?
Yeah.
Right, so let's try again. You're saying that the blind man on crutches hit you first, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right.
A clip from The Secret Barrister, Stories of the Law and How It's Broken. Three books, Nothing But the Truth, The Secret Barrister and Fake Law, The Truth About Justice in an Age of Lies, are all available commercially and all are narrated by Jack Hawkins. And A Boy in a China Shop, Life, Clay and Everything, written and read by Keith Brimmer-Jones, is available commercially now. That's it for today's special show recorded at the Boswell Book Festival. Thanks to Fiona Duff and everyone at Boswell and all the writers who gave time to appear on today's show. Red Sail will be back next week. And if you want to find either of us on Twitter, he's at Red Sail, REDSZELL, and I'm at Talking_Books.